And thanks for joining for another Blunt Business here on CannabisRadio.com. Thank you all for joining us and finding us here on the program, wherever you find your podcast, whether it be from initially CannabisRadio.com, the Cannabis Radio app, where you can find on all your app stores, and of course, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube Music, YouTube, and among others, iHeartRadio, all major podcast platforms. Really easy to go and find. Blunt Business is powered by the Buzz CRM, and I've talked about this exhaustively on this program, and it bears worth repeating. I am a broken record. Let's just make that clear. The 2025 redesign of the Buzz CRM is here, and it's more intuitive, faster, smarter than ever. I know because I use it. I use it because it has a lot of things when it comes to reaching out for lead generation, calls, texts, emails, everything. And you want something steady that works. I don't know about you, but I don't like having to work with a million different logins and passwords, or work with a million different platforms. Listen, platforms come and go, but with the Buzz CRM, if you have existing platforms you want to integrate, you have a lot of ways to do that right now. And 500 tools, marketing tools at your disposal. And if you want to know about all these marketing tools, you want to ask questions, you want to go ahead and learn about what's under the hood of the Buzz CRM, we will be having featured webinars coming up very soon. And if you want to be a part of it, stay tuned to thebuzzcrm.com. And if you don't even want to wait for the webinars, you're like, I'm going to test it out myself because it's such a low barrier to entry, such a low cost. Thebuzzcrm.com, thebuzzcrm.com. Just go ahead and find out about it today. Sign up because you know what? Maybe you help me out a little bit here because I could always use a little extra bump of the salary because much like podcasting, radio is a cruel mistress. If you don't know that, then you haven't been in the business before. But we're going to go into the legal profession and we're going to talk to my next guest here, who is the chair of the Cannabis, Hemp, and Psychedelics Practice Group at Mandelbaum Barrett PC, which he brings nearly a quarter century of litigation experience and hundreds of courtroom victories to the cannabis industry in New Jersey and New York. And he's recognized as Innovator of the Year, the top 200 cannabis and psychedelics attorney. He's done a lot of work in pro bono work, including amicus briefs, supporting athletes' rights to cannabis access, and advocating for therapeutic advancements. I'm here with Joshua Bochner. Thanks for being on with me, Josh.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Thanks for making on and making time for us. And one of the areas we want to go ahead and talk about now is a various issue that's come up to us that came to our attention initially. And I want to talk about that. That is the Workplace Impairment Recognition Evaluator's Mandate. So one, we're going to make sure to get people to understand what that's all about. It's a mandate that places significant responsibility on trained evaluators to distinguish between cannabis presence and actual impairment. Now, you're a sought-after speaker on education and social justice within the cannabis marketplace, and in your background, in your current role advising businesses in the cannabis sector, tell me about this tension between employers' need to maintain a safe workplace under the WIRE mandate and employees' right to privacy when it comes to traditional drug testing limitations and reflecting current impairment from cannabis and distinguishing the both.
Sure. So the first thing to understand is the important distinction between impairment and intoxication. So impairment is where you're actually impaired. You are evidencing, manifesting some indicia to suggest that you are under the influence of cannabis or perhaps any other narcotic, including alcohol, right? You're slurring your words. You're stumbling. You're falling asleep. You can't remember if you just said something. You're paranoid, perhaps. That's impairment. Intoxication, by contrast, is the level of any substance in bodily fluids, be it a blood alcohol test analogy, be it testing hair follicles, saliva, etc. The issue with cannabis, and I'm going to use the alcohol analogy to explain it, is that a blood alcohol test for alcohol basically evidences both intoxication and impairment at the same time because of the way alcohol is metabolized in the human body. So if you blow hot on the side of the road and your blood alcohol level exceeds 0.08 or whatever the limit is, it's reasonable to conclude that you are both intoxicated, having the presence of alcohol in your body, and you're impaired as a result of the presence of alcohol in your body. By contrast, cannabis can stay in a person's system for 30 to 45 days or longer. So you can be intoxicated, evidencing that you have cannabis in your blood, for example, but you are not impaired. You're again not evidencing any signs of actual impairment. So for example, you can get home on a Friday night, spark a joint,
right,
and enjoy your Friday evening. On Monday morning, you are not likely to be impaired from smoking that joint Friday night, and you will be able to show up to work and perform your work duties without any issue. But if your employer were to test you to determine if you were intoxicated, you would test hot. You would test positive because that Friday night joint will still be in your system.
Let me ask you a question, Joshua. Now, compared to the fact that there will be testing for alcohol, obviously for the other part, when it comes to if you're going through a sobriety test, nothing's being said about tobacco or what's being said of the what kind of lingering effects are that therein as well. The thing is that it's only because of the fact that cannabis has a lingering effect in your bloodstream, in your system, is the reason they can't really put anything there. But, I mean, are there any drug tests right now that have already been created to distinguish away from cannabis? And as it's just a matter of like a cost factor that some of these companies don't want to go to send to a third-party tester and go to this test?
No. And that's really the challenge here. I tell clients all the time who want to get into the cannabis space, whether they want to have a dispensary or a cultivation facility, you know, good luck. We'll help you. And if all goes well and the state regulator does its job and the federal government stays out of its way, yes, you'll hopefully be profitable. But if you want to make $1 billion tomorrow, come up with a roadside sobriety test to determine cannabis impairment. Every law enforcement agency in the country will purchase it. It simply does not exist.
Yep.
Now, we work with a lot of companies that are trying to develop a product like that, but they all require a baseline in effect.
Yeah.
So, for example, one requires you to use an app on your phone when you are completely sober and get a baseline. And the idea is then, if you're suspected of being impaired, you'll engage with the app again. And if you can't complete certain functions, it would suggest you're impaired. But it doesn't work alone. It also requires, again, some sort of blood work or saliva test or otherwise. It also requires at least two. We recommend HR folks or managers to actually look at you and have a conversation and see if there is any manifestation of impairment. It's not a standalone. There's another manufacturer that has basically, it's like an Oculus that you put on your head and it measures eye movement. And it, too, can determine if your eyes are not moving fluidly based on certain tests, you're possibly impaired. But it also requires a secondary or third source saying, yes, we've looked at this person, we've observed how they're acting, and we've got a blood test as well. So there is nothing alone, no test that can conclusively determine impairment from cannabis.
What if they had an option? If somebody is a regular cannabis user and they want to be able to go to work and traditional drug testing will not really be sufficient for an employer. What if they were given the chance to go to that third party tester more than once a month and just say, okay, Quest, LabCorp, whatever it is, you know, go ahead and take a urine test and every couple of weeks or what, three times a month, four times a month, go ahead and test and just make sure that everything stuffs out that everything right now in the test is consistent with the level of cannabis use I make, and it shows I'm not impaired. And you can see that my performance at work will show the same. Would that be a helpful thing? Would that be fair? And would that
be helpful? Because it's not going to show they're not impaired, right? It'll likely show if you're a frequent user, intoxication, but the blood test will not show impairment.
But what I'm saying is the employer can then determine the performance of that employee over the month, and they can determine, okay, well, he's been, you know, under the intoxication of it. I mean, he's under the influence, but he's not affecting his work. And look at the workflow he's had.
But then what value is of knowing that the person's intoxicated if they're not impaired? So for example, let's say the person smokes every Friday night. The blood work is always going to come back positive. But the individual is not going to be impaired. So what value does that blood work have to showing that they're impaired or not at work?
Well, it would be partly the third-party testing would be able to get more people in the door to charge for services. I mean, and also, would the insurance companies be involved in this at all? Like, if there's a health provider that's provided by the employer, or if they have to provide their own insurance in that other respect, Is there any involvement with that? Any intervention from them as well?
No, because again, the problem is if we're using a blood test again as the example, it proves nothing. The workplace impairment recognition evaluator, the WIRE, is to determine impairment, not intoxication. So all you're doing is confirming someone has cannabis in their bloodstream. You're doing nothing to establish whether they're actually impaired at work.
Right.
And that's
the part where, right. And so like my thing is just that, what's the easiest barrier for these enforcers to go and come and say, listen, okay, he uses, but it's like, there's no kind of distinction between. It's just that the drug testing requirements are put for the workplace and it's a necessary evil, let's just say, for them, I guess. But the part is that cannabis shouldn't be anything that's any more different than tobacco or alcohol. That should be the distinction. But it's because of what cannabis does and the entrepreneur, the entourage effect that it causes. It's so much to go to, but it's like a matter of, I don't understand if there wasn't another workaround. But again, like you said, there's no testing that can go with it. And just to go ahead and put a distinction across and say, okay, if this person's impaired, but he's not impaired, he's just in the influence and that's it. And there's enough proof out there to be said that it's such that way.
Well, that's the thing, again, to use the alcohol analogy. If you show up for work after lunch, I hope, not in the morning, and you've had 3 scotches, more likely than not, we're going to evidence impairment in addition to intoxication, right? And that impairment may not just be evidenced by your slurring your words, your slumbering, you don't have good hand-eye control or body control. You're also going to probably smell, right? And so there's no question if they test you, you're going to be both intoxicated and impaired. By contrast, again, you can smoke that joint Friday night. After lunch on Monday or Monday morning, you will be intoxicated, but you won't be impaired. That's, again, because of the way cannabis is metabolized in the body, different from alcohol. It has that, like you said, lingering effect in the body where it stays, but the actual impairment subsides. And it's a real challenge. I mean, for example, in New Jersey, the law requires every employer in New Jersey to have a trained WIRE. It doesn't matter if you're a multi-billion-dollar, 3,000 person employee company, or you are a 4-person landscaping company. Right now, the statute, and there's close to 400,000 businesses in New Jersey, each and every one of them is required to have a trained WIRE. Complicating that, which is just an unrealistic expectation, the criteria for determining impairment, which was issued by the Cannabis Regulatory Commission years ago on an interim basis, has not been updated. And that criteria requires the employer to make certain conclusions based upon observation. But because it applies to all drugs, it is internally inconsistent. So, for example, it asks you to determine whether the employee is talking rapidly or slowly, whether the employee seems highly energetic or sloth-like, right? If you're on cocaine, you're talking fast and you're highly energetic. If you're on heroin, you're talking slow and sloth-like, right? So how does it work? More concerning, it also says, does the employee have a runny nose? Does the employee have bloodshot eyes? Does the employee seem to be tired? Well, sure, the employee is sick and manifests those conditions. So none of it is in any way, shape, or form conclusive. And the burden is on the employer to make that determination without any of this guidance. Compounding all of that is medical use.
Right. And that's the part I want to ask about when it comes to medical cannabis. If it's something where instead of having somebody that wants to go ahead and continue to enjoy cannabis regularly, that it can't be a recreational or adult user, that the best course of action for them is, if there's a distinction in the mandate to say, okay, there are particular substances that are going to have lingering effects, and tie in medical cannabis to the same way SSRIs or painkillers might be administered, would that be something that would be a better resolve?
No, because for a couple of reasons. Firstly, medical cannabis use is protected in most states, but it's not protected at the federal level.
Right.
So, for example, if you're using SSRIs, you are subject to the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is a federal bill, federal legislation, that requires any employer to provide a reasonable accommodation to someone who suffers from a mental or physical disability. And if you have mental health issues, such that you're taking SSRIs, you're protected. But because cannabis is still illegal at the federal level, the federal government has determined it has no medicinal value, the ADA doesn't apply to protect you. So then you have, and we have this throughout cannabis, as you know, this cognitive dissonance between now 37 states and counting, legalizing medicinal use, the federal government saying there is no medicinal value, those states permitting it and also passing laws that protect someone who's using it medicinally. So basically a state analog to the federal ADA law, but that constant conflict that results. And then you also have some instances like in New Jersey, recently a court ruled that while medical use is protected, an individual who suffered an adverse employment action by their employer, so for example, the employer suspended or fired the individual for medical cannabis use, that employee doesn't have a private right of action to sue the employer. Only the state's Cannabis Regulatory Commission can do that. So the law is ever evolving. It is a hot mess, to be clear. I'll give you another example. There's also something called drug recognition evaluators, DREs, and WIRES are based on this. DREs were initially drug recognition experts, but they had to change the word E to evaluators, recognizing the lack of expertise. And this actually went all the way up to the New Jersey Supreme Court in a case called Olenowski, where he was pulled over and he was determined by someone who was purportedly trained, a law enforcement officer, to be a DRE. And the science, the purported science that this law enforcement officer employed, went all the way up to the New Jersey Supreme Court, who had a retired judge file a 300-page decision finding that DREs were scientifically established and admissible evidence. The court then rejected that. And the court said, yes, but under a different standard. So there's two standards that allow the admissibility of that evidence. One is higher than the other. The court said, we're going to lower the standard for admissibility, recognizing it wasn't scientifically sound. But nevertheless gave law enforcement the benefit of the doubt. The chief judge and others dissented, noting that if you're finding it scientifically reliable, why you then, in the same breath, have to lower the standard for admissibility because it's not reliable enough.
So I want to bring one more thing just into the forefront. The DEA and the rescheduling issues we already had, which right now, as of the latest report I'm hearing here, the DEA has notified an agency judge that the marijuana rescheduling process is still on hold, with no future actions currently scheduled as the matter sits before the acting administrator. And so the administrator law judge, John Mulrooney, has paused hearings. And we still are never going to know when we're going to get back on board to get the hearings through, even though there's been a lot of shady stuff going on in between. But I never asked this question before, because we know there would be medical research benefits when rescheduling goes from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3, if it does now at this point with the way things are on hold. And we know the financial benefits under the IRS Revenue Code Section 280E. But what if there is any change, if the rescheduling changes the perception of cannabis for an employer, because would it fall under the same realm as SSRIs and painkillers that are also under that scheduling? Would that make it easier then to go ahead and apply that cannabis is the same kind of intoxicant or some kind of substance that would be a lingering effect that could fall under that parameter? Would that make a difference if the rescheduling happened?
Yes, it could.
You can make an argument.
I'm not a proponent of rescheduling. I'm a proponent of descheduling. But it could, because it rescheduled would mean that it's now prescribed, which has a whole host of other issues. So for example, arguably, every dispensary would need a pharmacist, right?
Yeah.
There's not enough pharmacists in the country, right? So right off the top, rescheduling just tactically doesn't work. But to your point, yes. For example, again, the American Disabilities Act would then apply to the cannabis user at the federal level and protect that use. Now, it doesn't allow anyone to show up at work impaired. So for example, you can have a prescription for Xanax, but if you take 20 and you show up for work and you fall asleep at your desk.
Yeah.
That's not protected, right?
Oh, no, no.
Right? So, you still have to recognize those issues. The difference would be, presumably, if it were rescheduled, you would then have doctors prescribe. We would have a lot more information on dosing than we already do. And the doctor would say, okay, you're a 50-year-old white male. You are 6 foot tall, 250 pounds. You should be using 3.5 milligram microdose every day, right? That would then hopefully, through the science and testing and research, be enough to have the medicinal benefits of cannabis without causing observable impairment.
And that's the part I'm really kind of thinking about, is that if we get to the point where we get to the rescheduling, if there were ever to happen, you can make the argument for it, which would be great. And that would be another part I never even, another wrinkle I never even thought about, because you could argue it out. I mean, the same case I'm thinking about right now, there will be precedents that will be made after rescheduling happens, if it does, because one of the things would be, I know there was the company that wanted to go ahead and say, well, if we can then start writing off our taxes, let's see if we can get the IRS to write off our last 3 years of taxes and recoup those funds. That was one thing. I forget the company, it doesn't come up to me right now, but I know I had it, and I have to go back and look again. But there's that. And I would imagine then that someone would go ahead and have someone like you representing to make the argument, the case that, well, my employer doesn't need to go ahead and reach out to me and you know, subject me to drug testing or says I can't work here, because now cannabis falls under the distinction of the Americans with Disabilities Act, I can argue, and then you can make that case. So if rescheduling happens, that's another benefit that people need to go and be aware of. I never knew about this, and I appreciate you making this point. It won't say necessarily it will be set in stone after that, but you can argue the case and probably be able to have a good case at it. You would think, if you had to go and argue that, do you think you would do pretty well? You think you could do a good case with it?
Well, you'd have a number of federal protections apply that currently don't apply. You'd also have a number of federal protections that, for example, drug-free workplace is a federal law, right? If you are a recipient of federal funds, federal grants, et cetera, the federal government can require you to maintain a drug-free workplace, even if you're in a state where there's lawful medical and adult use. There's also a lot of reasonable carve-outs for cannabis use. Airplane pilots, for example, right? You never want an airplane pilot testing positive under the current scenario. People operate heavy machineries. There's actually literally an exception for people who work in nuclear reactors, right? Where it is binary. You cannot be impaired or intoxicated. Zero tolerance, right? Because of those, they're called highly sensitive positions, right? So we would have to determine with those federal laws, with the rescheduling, how that would apply and to whom. Again, I think rescheduling, if you want to fix the biggest problems with cannabis, you pass the Safe Banking Act and you fix 280E. You don't need to reschedule to do those things. 280E is a legacy, as I'm sure you know, because in 1981, a drug dealer was flying cocaine in on his private plane and took the plane as a deduction and it was upheld. Because there was no 280E. So he was able to take that deduction for the use of his plane to import cocaine. Congress then passed 280E, obviously not anticipating law of unintended consequences, legalization of cannabis, 20, 30 years later. So 280E is an easy fix. I actually think the Trump administration is better served not doing anything with cannabis for a number of reasons. First of all, they're states' rightists, right? They want to leave it to the states, as they've done with abortion, for example. So leave it to the states. Don't get the federal government involved. They're anti-federal regulation. Fine. Don't get the federal government involved. They're anti-imports. All cannabis has to be grown domestically to be lawful. In fact, it has to be grown in the state if you're anti-imports. Trump has shown himself to be anti-Mexican. You don't want Mexican weed coming across the border. Legalize it here. And it's working and generating a lot of tax revenue, both for the states and the federal government. So there's no good reason for the Trump administration to engage. And by doing nothing, they win.
Yeah. I just want the process. Well, we all would have wanted the process to be done sooner. But for whatever reason, I'm right now going through marijuana moment. They're going through so much here about the rescheduling process that there were supposed to be certain people that were supposed to be able to go ahead and testify about this, and they never got that done. Like, there's a whole lot being said about procedural missteps throughout his rescheduling process. And marijuana moment details here, I'm going to make some of these points here real quick, and we'll go to break. But December criticized agency for making a critical blunder in effort to issue subpoenas to the FDA to testify in hearings. A lawsuit seeking to compel DEA to turn over communications with the anti-cannabis organization, I forget which one it is here, and denying a research company's request to allow to add a young medical marijuana patient and advocate as a witness in the rescheduling hearings, among other things. So like, there's so much here that's going wrong. That, you know, we're just hearing all these accusations, but it's like nothing's being done about it. We're not moving forward. Okay. We'll figure it out, but we're going to table that here. We're going to go into the area of compliance in New Jersey. You actually wrote an article with JD Supra about the recent CRC's updated testing guidance, and we'll talk more about that and see what compliance standards in New Jersey now has in place. You can definitely go and be in depth in telling us about them. I'm here with Joshua Wagner, chair of the Cannabis, Hemp, and Psychedelics Practice at Mandelbaum Barrett, BC, here on Blunt Business. We'll be back with more questions after this. Welcome back to Blunt Business. I'm here with Joshua Wagner, chair of the Cannabis, Hemp, and Psychedelics Practice Group at Mandelbaum Barrett, BC. So earlier this month, Joshua's recording here in April, you actually wrote an article regarding cannabis safety in New Jersey, the CRC's, or the Cannabis Regulatory Commission's, testing and compliance standards. So this is only yesterday as we're recording.
Hey, Drew and Jonathan Scott here. Build a customized renter's policy with American Family Insurance, so you can protect your tandem bike on the go.
Thief!
Oh, he is struggling with that two-seater. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at amfam.com.
Some exclusions may apply. Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, SI and its operating companies. 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
That you actually had this out published. And you may mention of that they are undergoing a transformation with increased emphasis on safety, transparency, and quality assurance. And their public meeting on February 18th, they released a full updated cannabis lab testing guidance with further clarification of existing regulations to ensure consumer safety and boost public confidence in cannabis products. Now, with that, you highlighted the updated testing guidance and the temporary waiver in response to concerns by the Safely Society's study, given the allowance for remediation of moldy cannabis through radiation treatment, a point you acknowledge is controversial. I wanted to just get your thoughts on the balance between ensuring product availability, maintaining high standards of consumer safety, and what else the CRC could consider to address consumer concerns regarding remediated products.
So this comes down to, as so many things do, to cost. So there's really competing interests here. So we implement the new testing requirements that the CRC has proposed here is incredibly expensive for the labs. And of course, most of that cost is going to be passed on to the licensee. And of course, then they're going to pass that cost on to the consumer. So what we have here is consumers wanting product that is, of course, you know, free of mold, pesticides, heavy metals, and residual solvents, but not wanting to pay $200 an ounce or more to have that product. And so we have here, as we so often do with government, a pendulum shift from one extreme to the other. And so the CRC found that the current testing requirements were insufficient, and that it resulted in, from some study that was conducted, it resulted in products having all of those problems, right? They concluded that a significant proportion of the product that was being sold to consumers actually did have mold and pesticides and vermin and the like. So the pendulum then shifts to the other extreme, where they now want testing that confirms almost a zero tolerance policy. What we really need is that happy middle ground, right? And that's frankly what the FDA has done over a half century, right? Whether people want to recognize it or not, there's actually a minimum amount or maximum amount of rodent detritus, rodent poop, for lack of a better term, that could be in your Cheerios, right? Nobody wants to believe that. But the fact of the matter is there's minimums that they'll allow, or maximums, excuse me, that they'll allow in food of pretty much any of these things. That's where we need to be with cannabis. We're never going to have a zero tolerance policy. It's a plant like anything else. There's going to be insects and mold and the rest. But what we want to do is create a policy, of course, that ensures the least possible amount of those residues to ensure the healthiest product available. The new regs just go to that far extreme and basically try to eliminate it altogether.
So that Safely Society study, I want to just make sure to make a context for that. They were saying that they revealed that legal cannabis products in New Jersey contain significantly higher levels of yeast, mold, and bacteria allowed, while being far less potent than advertised. They had purchased 25 pre-rolled joints from licensed dispensaries and tested them and found that 7 exceeded microbial contamination limits, with two nearly 5 times over the legal cap, and others they had well below the allowable 10% potent discrepancy, with one just having half the advertised potency. There was a lot of rigmarole going through all that. Now, the other thing that was being talked about here is the area of lab shopping. It's a key aspect of the new testing guidance. So one of the most significant challenges for this Cannabis Regulatory Commission in effectively reinforcing this provision of lab shopping, and tell me any specific mechanisms or oversight measures you believe would be most crucial in preventing cannabis businesses from seeking out labs with more lenient testing standards. And I mean, well, that just comes down to the lab testing facilities being cracked down versus the dispensaries.
So this is something that, again, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. So for example, a few years back, there was a law that was passed that said companies needed to change their auditor every few years, right? Because there was concern, and this blew up with the whole financial crisis, right? You were using Enron, right? Enron used the same auditor, and that auditor over a term became so embedded with Enron that it overlooked things. It took Enron's advice. Enron said, oh, you know, don't look in that room. Look in this other room. Don't look at that financial disclosure. Ignore the footnotes. And the auditor said, fine, because the auditor wanted its multi-million dollar fee every year. So a law was passed that's, I think it's every 3 years, companies have to retain a new auditor. It's that simple here. If a cannabis company operator, licensee, wants to pick Lab X, it should stick with Lab X for 3 years, and then it should go to Lab Y. And this will ensure that it's not shopping for favorable results, but it can create that relationship with a lab for a period of time, and then have a check on that after 3 years to go to another lab who might have different results. That's all we need to do here. Again, we don't need that pendulum swing from one extreme to the other.
So now in New York, we know that we've talked quite a lot about when it comes to what they're doing right now. And one of the areas they have created when they overhauled the Office of Cannabis Management is they now have the Trade Practices Bureau. So now this particular bureau, they are able to go and take action against complex trade practice violations. And they can go through and have, you know, attorneys, inspectors, investigators, then analysts, forensic accountants and disposal, and go through various issues, which also include various areas of compliance. Now, because if you see what you're seeing to what that OCM is doing right now in New York, it's always been a comparison about what's New York's version of compliance versus New Jersey's interpretation. And it's a part where obviously some companies probably find more in favor of New Jersey because of there has maybe so much restrictions or so much regulations put in place versus New York, which is like what a maze to go through to try to get everything done, just let alone just try to get a social equity license or a CURD a card license, and get that all the way up to inspection, up to opening, grand opening. It's like all the work that I got to go through that. There's that part. It's just too much of an issue. But is there any example that New Jersey's falling on these compliance testing standards that you would say would be probably the best example right now? Because the one thing we got to worry about it too is that one of the programs we host here on Cannabis Radio is Planting Seeds. We've been talking extensively with State Senator Sheree Street, who is one of the co-authors of the bill to create adult use cannabis and make that legal across the state, the Commonwealth. But they also are going to be following what their neighbors to the north and to the west are going to be doing in their compliance standards. So is there one right now that you look at that would be the best example that New Jersey could be following, and eventually maybe Pennsylvania should follow as well?
So the best example is usually Colorado. Colorado's program was established all the way back in 2014, both medicinal and adult use, which followed. They have had an exceptionally successful rollout. They have generated significant tax revenue. Every time I go out there, the road from the airport to downtown Denver is freshly repaved. Every school has a fresh coat of paint. And back when Hickenlooper was governor, he was actually trying to create a state chartered bank just for cannabis.
Right.
So, you know, it's thriving. I often suggest that both New York and New Jersey should have just taken Colorado's legislation and did a replace all and substituted New Jersey or New York for Colorado and be done. For better or for worse, you know, folks out here on the East Coast thought they knew better and tried to create things from whole cloth. And to your point, that's why we have New Jersey being, I would say, probably CC plus with its program, and New York being probably an F. You know, what you called an overhaul, I would call a decimation. Right? The OCN and that scathing report that was issued last May found that it was basically just an incompetent organization through and through that had tried to, as we've been discussing, create all these new policies, procedures, even computer IT infrastructure anew, which it didn't need to do. And it was a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the adults in the room, and by that I mean the general counsel and her office, were scandalized and I think quit. And they are all terrific people. They are smart. They are competent attorneys, but they all quit. The state then gave $13 million in funding to basically engage in enforcement efforts. So what we have in New York is this horrible duality of, we realize that, as you pointed out, our licensing program is a mess and a failure. So rather than create a safe and regulated market by licensing cannabis operators, we're just going to push that aside, ignore the original legislation, right, Murdo, and focus on enforcement.
Right.
And that's what they've been doing for the past year, where they have been going around raiding, you know, licensed temp stores, for example, unlicensed stores because their panties in are a bunch that, you know, there's all these unlicensed bodegas and cannabis stores in New York City predominantly, and ignoring creating a safe and regulated market. Now, we've seen, again, out west, Colorado, California, if you create a safe and regulated market, and you're taxing it properly, and you're testing it properly, people like you and me would prefer to spend $50, perhaps, on an eighth, rather than $30 buying it from the kid on the corner, knowing what you're getting. Knowing what you're getting is safe, tested, doesn't have, you know, the vermin, the pesticides, and all the rest. It's got proper THC concentrations. It's labeled. It's not, you know, a Ziploc bag from the kid on the corner, or, you know, something that folds from underneath the counter in a bodega. People will pay a little bit more for that because they want it to be safe. That's the goal, right? You eliminate the black market, as they've done out west, by creating a safe and regulated market. But because New York failed to do that, they just keep targeting the black market. Yeah. And that's just failed, right? These stores pop up as soon as they're shut down. And what we've had, and we have a case against the state and the city pending right now, we actually got an injunction against the state and the New York City Sheriff's Office on behalf of hemp licensees, because the state, in its infinite wisdom, was going in. New York is one of the only states that distinguishes between cannabis and hemp as opposed to marijuana and hemp. And of course, both marijuana and hemp are cannabis. They come from the same cannabis sativa plant.
Yeah.
So they're going into these hemp licensees who are operating perfectly lawfully and saying, aha, you're selling cannabis without a cannabis license. And the hemp licensees are saying, well, yeah, hemp is cannabis. We're selling cannabis, but with a hemp license. And they get shut down. They get padlocked. Their product is seized and destroyed. Criminal charges are filed, all because the state, and this is the problem with New York, this is, you know, why I'm giving them an S, all because the state distinguishes between cannabis and hemp rather than marijuana and hemp. It's a simple matter of nomenclature, and they're putting people out of business and destroying their lives.
And that's the Pangea case that you're representing right now. That is that particular case.
That is, it's called the Super Smoking case. And the judge issued an injunction completely stopping the sheriff from conducting any raids, finding the sheriff's office didn't have the competency. The lieutenant in the sheriff's office responsible for the raids when I was cross-examining her, I said, how can you determine THC concentrations? How do you know it's exceeding that 0.3% delta 9 concentration in health? And you're not going to believe this. She said she could smell THC concentrations. Exactly. You laugh. You laugh. And I,
oh my goodness.
Hilarious. They're not looking at the certificates of analysis. They're not seeing the lab tests. She's smelling it. And I just looked at the judge, and the judge looked at me, and I said, Your Honor, I think I've made my point. He said, I think you have, because he understood the absurdity. So you have the sheriff, armed officers, going into licensed operators, lawful, licensed hemp licensees, and raiding them with a sheriff thinking that she can smell the flower. So what I actually did was I had two canisters, one with hemp and one with marijuana. And I said, which is which? And of course, she couldn't tell the difference because they're the same damn plant. They look the same. They smell the same. When you smoke them, they're the same. Other than obviously one will have a psychoactive effect.
So, all right. I was going to bring up the part about opinion, but you already kind of covered that part. But what I want to do now is I want to get back into testing and just get a little final thoughts on the testing process right now and where it stands right now in New Jersey. I want to go ahead and go to one more commercial break and ask you about that. Here again with Joshua Bochner, the chair of the Cannabis, Hemp, and Psychedelics Practice Group at
Mandelbaum
PC. Because it doesn't cover in the Google Doc. It just doesn't. It's like cut that off. I have to find it again. And I'll be back with Joshua's final question after this. Welcome back once again. I'm with Joshua Bochner, chair of the Cannabis, Hemp, and Psychedelics Practice Group at Mandelbaum Barrett PC. And for those who want to go ahead and follow along, and if you're looking to go ahead and follow along more with Joshua and keep in touch and connect with his team of attorneys, they are looking in Roseland, New Jersey, and you can find their website at mblawfirm.com, mblawfirm.com. And we'll talk more about that in just a moment, just before you get more information about that. I want to just finish up real quick about cannabis safety in New Jersey. And you concluded the article about the new changes by the Cannabis Regulatory Commission, that it's a critical step in strengthening consumer protection and industry accountability, and that they are trying to ensure that products meet the highest safety standards. But obviously, compliance is not just a regulatory obligation. It's essential for maintaining consumer trust, avoiding legal repercussions, and ensuring the long-term success of the market. And consumer safety must remain a priority. Failing to meet these standards could lead to severe financial and legal consequences. So they made more changes, but if you had to pick several more things that need to be done here, besides the fact they want to go ahead and put rigorous testing standards, reinforcing lab integrity, and introducing measures to prevent contamination and mislabeling, what are the other areas that they're missing right now that they absolutely should have done this time around?
With respect to testing, again, I think they should simply require that every couple of years, 3 years, whatever it may be, operators switch to a different lab. I think they need to reconsider, again, that pendulum swing with kind of a zero tolerance policy, to recognize, as with your Cheerios, there's always going to be some concentration of vermin, pesticides, whatever it might be in the product, and recognize the cost imposition. Because again, what they've done here is dramatically increase the cost of compliance for the labs, who again are going to pass it on to the cannabis licensees, who are going to pass it on to the consumers. So going back to our discussion about New York, if you want to eliminate that black market by creating a safer and regulated market, you can't charge 3 and 4 times the black market price, right? You can charge 15 or 20% more. But if the difference in an eighth is, $200, because you've had to spend all this money on lab testing, and the $30 eight you're getting on the corner again, that's not going to work. And again, we've seen out west where they've kind of found that delicate balance, that sweet spot for pricing.
The other part I want to ask about was, there hasn't been much said about the, like, because your firm also handles cases in relation to psychedelics. And there was a plan where lawmakers were looking into criminalizing psilocybin and looking in favor of a bill allowing for therapeutic uses from last year. And there was also a Senate panel that advanced a bill for magic mushrooms, legalizing them for therapeutic use. Is there anything you can tell me right now in terms of any other possible regulations or anything that comes across where I mean, that's really any growth on the psychedelics market. Do you feel like there's been a stunting of the growth in the market? Because, I mean, there was a point where I felt like we had a lot of momentum a couple of years ago. And it's kind of just stood still right now because there's not a lot of the states that we thought were going to start going in and legalizing psychedelics. It kind of just stopped on the wayside. I don't know if there's something about any kind of press or what it is that's caused this to go, but I don't know if it's public demand or if it's just a slowdown of all that momentum of psychedelics being grown, and where is it in New Jersey right now?
So not just New Jersey, but, you know, nationally, what we're seeing is frankly a kind of passive indifference. So a lot of hospitals that initially wouldn't get into the psychedelic space, be it psilocybin, ketamine, because they're afraid of losing their federal funding, just ignored it. Primarily because these medical professionals are recognizing the tremendous value in using psychedelics for treatment. For example, PTSD. You know, our country was at war for the longest period of time in its history. We had all of our vets come back, not all of them, many of them come back suffering from horrible PTSD, and their treatment just wasn't working. What they found was, by example, one ketamine treatment, one, could actually have dramatic effects on resolving their PTSD. So I think what we're seeing is the government slowly recognizing this at the pragmatic level, at the practical level, and as a result, just kind of taking a hands-off policy. So these hospitals are no longer worried about losing their funding. They have clinical trials, Johns Hopkins, NYU, MD Anderson, you name it. All the big hospitals are engaging this. And frankly, it's becoming readily accessible. So you could go online and find, you know, more often than not, a nurse who will secure for you the ketamine, if we're going to use that example, psilocybin, whatever it may be, and take you on that journey, right? They will meet with you. They will speak with you. They will then guide you through it, give you, administer the medicine, talk with you through that 4, 6, 8 hour window, make sure that you're addressing what you want to address, not going to any dark places, come back out of it, do a consult after that, speak with your primary care physician or your therapist, as the case may be. And all of this is happening. It's all technically illegal, right? It all technically puts people at risk of losing their licensure, but nobody gives a damn because it works. The other thing that's happening, and this is again at the federal level, we became involved in what's called the Ames litigation. And the Ames litigation is currently pending in the Ninth Circuit, which is again out west, where a doctor wanted to use psychedelics to treat certain conditions, particularly end of life. And we had been litigating that case for a long time against, as you pointed out earlier, both the FDA and DEA, who continue to rely on science that's 50, 60, 70 years old. And as a result, they're ignoring everything we just discussed with the tremendous benefits that we're seeing today. So we actually filed a brief, an amicus brief, friend of the court brief, on behalf of NORML, the National Organization for Marijuana Law. And the argument in our brief is it took us over 50 years to decriminalize cannabis, recognizing its tremendous medicinal value, right? There wouldn't be an opioid crisis in this country today, I believe, if cannabis were legal. Non-addictive pain medication, yeah. Right? So our argument was we can't wait another 50 years to legalize psychedelics. So if the DEA and the FDA want to simply abdicate their regulatory responsibility and rely on science from the 60s and 70s, then get them out of the way, right? Ignore them. Because we need this medicine now. We should not be denying patients. We should not be denying veterans medicine that we know will help them because of some dated misunderstanding of the science. That case has been going on for years now.
Yeah.
It's pending. The court has been very favorable and keeps going back to the DEA and the FDA and saying, show us more. And much like with the rescheduling issue we discussed earlier, the government is basically saying, you know, we got nothing.
Yeah.
We're giving up.
We got to leave it there. Running out of time on my end. I got to get another interview. But Joshua, really appreciate you taking time to go and talk to us about this. And also want to make the distinction, the super smoker case you mentioned earlier, before we went to break, that's not the same as the Pangea case, setting a precedent for transparency in New Jersey's cannabis application process. It's where you're representing plaintiffs challenging in New York the state's hemp regulations. So I want to make sure there's a distinction there.
Yes.
But let's go to the website real quick and just take a minute again, tell people Let's go to mblawfirm.com, mblawfirm.com for Mandelbaum, Barrett. And real quickly, just tell me about the side of the practice you serve right now and why they should go ahead and reach out to you and where.
Sure, I appreciate that. So if you go onto the website, there's a Cannabis Heaven Psychedelics page that has all the information about how, as attorneys, we can help you. Licensing and compliance work, corporate formation and governments. We work a lot with banks. We're helping state charter banks and credit unions thread the needle to provide banking services to our clients. But anything you need, real estate, intellectual property, litigation. We do a lot of work with the hospitality industry, where restaurants are now having infused meals that they're serving at special events. So it really is both our practice in the cannabis and psychedelic space and the firm, a full service firm. And I invite your listeners to check us out and feel free to contact me with any questions.
All right. Thank you so much for being on the week. Once again, Joshua Bogner, chair of the Cannabis, Hemp, and Psychedelics Practice Group at Mandelbaum Barrett PC. And thank you for being on us once again, Josh. And we'll definitely go and open the door to have you back home once again.
Thank you very much. I'd love to.
And thank you, listeners, for listening to another Blunt Business. We'll talk to you next time. The opinions expressed on this CannabisRadio.com program are those of the guests, hosts, and participants, and not necessarily those of CannabisRadio.com. Any rebroadcast or retransmission without proper consent is prohibited.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King. Hey, Drew and Jonathan Scott here. Build a customized renter's policy with American Family Insurance so you can protect your tandem bike on the go. Thief! Oh, he is struggling with that two-seater. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at amfam.com.
Some exclusions may apply. Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies. 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.